Today's Feast of Fools, Rick Stokes. Longtime gay rights activist talks about his life, the legacy of his work, and how he started Steamworks, the gay men's bathhouse.
Born and raised in Kansas, Rick Stokes married a woman despite his same-sex desires. When these same desires wouldn't go away, his family convinced him to undergo electroshock therapy to cure him of homosexuality. He eventually stopped the painful treatment and moved to California. Rick became a lawyer and defended gay people in court and created gay rights groups.
He later ran against Harvey Milk for supervisor seat in 1977 and lost. He will be portrayed in the upcoming film Milk by Broadway actor Steven Spinella. Listen as we talk about fighting for gay rights in America, when being gay was illegal,
finding the man of your dreams,
and where we're all headed in our collective fight for sexual diversity. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Killian.
And this is Feast of Fools.
Come and get it!
Feast of Fools is brought to you by generous support of fantastic, fabulous listeners just like you.
We really can't do this show without your support, so please visit our website, feastoffools.net, and make a donation.
Get a mug, get a t-shirt.
Every single penny you donate to the show makes a world of a difference.
Thank you.
We really mean it.
This gay fun show is also brought to you in part by Steamworks, gym, sauna, and baths.
Release the pressure!
Saca la presión. Steamworks.
Steamworks is a comfortable and stylish place to meet other men, relax, work out, and play. Open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to men 18 and over in Berkeley, Chicago, Toronto, and now Seattle, Washington.
When you're ready to play, Steamworks is ready for you.
Visit steamworksonline.com and register to get a discount on your next visit. Enter Feast of Fools on the promo code field to get the special discount. And remember,
play hard, play smart.
So, can I call you Ricky?
Yes.
I can. How fantastic. We have Rick Stokes, a legendary lawyer who ran against Harvey Milk in 1976 and is part... You're not in the movie Milk the movie. Somebody's actually playing you in the movie.
That's right.
That's coming out in October and... You know, by many people in Hollywood are saying that it's going to be an Oscar winner. So what is it like to be involved in such a project? I mean, did they interview you for this film?
No, when they came, actually, I was out of the country on vacation, and the filming was fairly short amount of time that was filming, and nobody ever contacted me again. I made a little effort too late to reach them,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't reach me.
So let's go back to the very beginning. You were born and raised in Oklahoma, and you were married to a woman.
That's right.
And before you guys got married, you actually told her that you had a romantic relationship with a man.
Yeah, and that I had many relationships with men, but I had one particularly intense relationship with one young man who started out as a boy when I was 10 and he was 12, and it lasted all through both of our teenagers to growing up. He got married. Uh-huh. I got married.
And so your wife was marrying you knowing that you had same-sex romantic feelings. How was that going to be addressed?
Well, she didn't really address it, but I'm just assuming from the whole context that, like so many American women, and certainly a good Baptist girl from Oklahoma, she assumed once we were married and, quote, having normal sex, that whole desire would just fade away.
Because back then,
it didn't.
And back then, people didn't really understand what it was to be gay or understand how that would happen, especially if you're from a smaller town. You don't have the context in which to place it. So you guys decided to get married anyway, and you thought because you'd be married, you would have, a happy marriage. When did things start to go wrong in the marriage?
Well, back up for a second. Growing up, of course, there'd been a lot of boys that I'd been involved with, but I'd watched them all one by one find a girl, get married, and go into, quote, the normal life that was handed out. There were no models for two males or two females in Oklahoma. I mean, everybody grew up and got married. There wasn't any other life. And so when a woman came along, and actually she was 6 years my senior, Our families had known each other, but they weren't on the same economic planes. She and I met when I was home on leave from service one time, and we liked each other. I loved to dance. She loved to dance. It was a lot of fun. Her family, as I said, was more well-to-do, a lot more well-to-do than my family. And looking back and trying to analyze what was going on, what are the dynamics, I'm sure to some degree the stuff that I was being exposed to, the stuff like meeting political figures that were important figures, having the first suit that I'd ever had in my life to wear, going to fancy places and doing fancy things was all sort of overwhelming. It was interesting to be a part of this family that mm-hmm. did things on a scale I'd never even thought about, you know.
So did you get a divorce and then try to cure your homosexuality through electroshock therapy? Or did that process happen while you were married?
It was while I was married. I was involved in a very bad automobile accident in 1957, I guess it was, about 2.5 mm-hmm. years into the marriage, and skull fracture and brain concussion at that particular time.
Sorry, we're closing a window because there's an ambulance outside making a racket. So you were going to seek medical treatment to cure yourself of what you believed was being gay.
But this is the wrong emphasis. I wasn't seeking anything. My in-laws, together with my parents,
really?
My parents were very unsophisticated people, blue-collar people.
Sure.
Those four individuals plus my wife decided that I needed to have psychotherapy, that we could cure me of this homosexuality. Well, here are the most important people in my life, five of them, all telling me this was good
people
for
you
me.
Loved.
Yeah, so I went along with it.
And what does the process involve? I mean, like you would go to a clinic?
Well, actually, my wife had undergone psychotherapy and her first marriage had come to an end. And this man who was a psychologist was a very important person. He headed the Oklahoma Mental Health Department, but as well as having a private practice and a small hospital. So that was the doctor that I went to see. And I remember so well that initial meeting with him in which afterwards, he said, well, we could castrate you, but let's try shock therapy.
Castrating meaning like removing your genitals.
Exactly. Which was a very scary thing. And then I was assigned to a young doctor in the clinic. And the young doctor, after we spent a long time together, an initial meeting, looked at me very solemnly and said, well, your wife and your mother are the two people who need these treatments, but you're the one who's been selected, so let's get started.
Wow.
Very inauspicious way to start off.
So how did he
impart something to you, saying that you're not the crazy one, that they are?
Well, certainly it sounds like that to me.
And it was Shawnee, Oklahoma, right?
That's right.
What year was this? Or what time period?
57 to 58.
So in the late 50s, mm-hmm. you were going to get electroshock therapy.
Right.
Which involved what exactly?
Well, initially there was an in-house in the clinic where I was for 2 weeks. And it, as best as I can remember, that the treatments were every day or at the least every other day for those 2 weeks. Did you want the mechanics of what?
Tell us the gruesome details. Yeah. I mean, because you were telling me before we started taping that you were waiting outside to be called on.
Right. Well, this is after you're out of the outpatient. You're driving back from your home twice a week initially, then once a week and less frequently. But whenever, whatever time it was, you would go into a room and wait for your turn to be called to actually have the treatment. Then when finally, awfully, that time did arrive and there was no getting away from it, you go into a room, you're put on a gurney, you're given a shot to knock you out. About the time that the shot's taking effect and you're actually losing consciousness, why a box is being wheeled in from another room where it's been being used on somebody else and being plugged into the wall, and the electrodes are all being placed on your head.
Not your genitals, though, or just
no,
your head?
No, it's just your head.
I think they're trying to, the purpose of electroshock therapy is to make you forget things, really, I think is what the main thing that it does.
Well, I asked specifically, what is it that we're supposed to be accomplishing with this? And the metaphor that was used was that the brain, with all of the pieces of it, are like a blackboard with little movable letters, and we're going to throw all these letters up in the air with a shock treatment and let them come down where they will. sound very unscientific.
I mean, sounds very chaotic, yeah, though. Yeah. You know, what I mean, if it's a chaotic process, what's the guarantee that you won't be even more gay?
I don't think there was any guarantee.
You
know,
like you woke up the next day and you were Liberace or something. I mean, that's a kind of a joke, but I mean, seriously, why did they feel that electrocuting people was a way of dealing with what they perceived to be mental illness?
I don't know. I know it was in vogue at that time, and it was used for all kinds of perceived mental illness. Remember, that was still at a time when being mentally ill was one step away from being a criminal. There's something really badly wrong with people who are mentally ill. It wasn't just that you had a sickness, which happened to be a mental sickness.
You're rotten to the core.
There's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. And it's still used today, and it's used, I think, primarily for people that have suffered some kind of, like, traumatic incidents of violence against them to kind of, like, make them forget. But the side effects of this is kind of, what was it like after a treatment, when you were done with the treatment?
It was a very restful sleep that you had. Usually would sleep for maybe 45 minutes to an hour. But the problem was then going back into the little community where we lived, I was aware that they'd literally blocked out a semester of work at school. I would meet people on the street coming up to me to say, "Hi, Rick, who are you? How are you?" And I hadn't any idea who this person was. I'd never seen them before in my life. And it turns out they were in a class with me sitting next to me.
For months on end.
Yeah, that you're learning to deal with that. I mean, that's very, very freaky.
And unnerving, I can imagine. So, I mean, when you go to a dentist today and you get going through anesthesia, do you get a little anxious or?
No. Fortunately, I've never had that experience. But the experience of going out, going under to the drugs, is something that I underwent for some 8 years afterwards, that I could be lying down on the van reading or something, or about to go to sleep, and suddenly the brain flashes back to being in that hospital on a gurney about to go out from the drug, and literally feeling like you had to jump up, take hold of your brain with your hands, figuratively speaking, and I'm not back there, I'm here. I'm in control of where I am and what I'm doing.
So you said this was a kick in the pants that you got to make you pursue your dreams of falling in love with a man and moving to a place in the country where you could have that relationship. And that's how you came to come to San Francisco.
That's true. And that all came out of that experience I was relating to. I'm walking down the street in this little town one day, and a young man is walking towards me, and I'm consciously aware that I'm trying to block him out and not seeing him at all. And something clicked in my brain and said, "You're helping these people take away from you a very significant part of your life, of who you are. And nobody's even intimated that they're going to be able to give you something to replace that with. What's going on here?" And that was the point at which I said, "I'm out of here. I'm not going to participate in this anymore. I know there's nothing wrong with me. I like me. I'm totally all right like I am. Why am I letting these people, much as I may have loved them, try to remake who I am to fit their fantasies? They're the one who had the problem with my homosexuality, not me. It's always been a source of joy and pleasure to me."
Well, and, I mean, it's like just walking around the streets of San Francisco and you see some of these hot Russian men or the bellhops. And it's like, we need beauty in our lives, you know? Why blocking out a man or a woman from your consciousness? I mean, talk about a messed up construct. Yeah, and there are people to this day that still go through this kind of treatment and try to, you know, change their attraction or what they consider to be beautiful, you know?
It's true, and I don't know what to say. Psychotherapy has over the years included all kinds of things, drugs, as well as electroshock treatment. For a long time, electroshock treatment was very much not in favor. But it, at least a few years ago, the last time I had any interaction with this, it is again in use. And apparently there are circumstances, really dramatically severe circumstances, in which it can be useful. That's hard for me to even say those words, but from my own horror experience, it's a no-no. How anybody could ever do that to another living human being.
Now, you got involved in helping to create and maintain a lot of gay rights liberation groups in San Francisco. So one was SIR, which sounds very gay. What is that? The Society for Individual Rights.
That's correct.
And then the other one was ARC.
That ARC was something that I, together with David's help, my lover of 35 years, created in Sacramento. SIR, at that time, you have to stop and think, in the 60s, gay men were extremely fearful of having their name, anything about them known. And so to be, to belong to an organization like SIR, of course, you had certain membership requirements, and there was always the fear, who has access to these records? Well, when I came to the people in SIR and said, I would like to start a chapter in Sacramento, where David and I lived, they were crazy about the idea, but not about the reality of having to have somebody else have access to their membership records. And so, I mean, quickly came to me that the best way of dealing with this to have what I wanted, an organization working with the same kind of rights SIR was in San Francisco, but in Sacramento, where David and I live, was to start our own. And in those days, because people were paranoid about anyone knowing that they were gay, you had to find some nice innocuous name. And so Association for, what was ARC? Association for Responsible Citizenship. Was
Responsible Citizenship.
The name.
It sounds like an anti-communist league or something.
Well, I mean, if you even to this day, you have human rights campaign.
Sure.
You know, why not just call it like the freedom of cocksucking or something. Something really, you know, bold. I mean, considering that being gay, the identity of gay and the behavior and same-sex relationships in that time period was a criminal offense. Was it hard to organize or create even an organization where its very existence might be seen by the law as criminal?
You almost have to define your word hard. Obviously, put lots of challenges to me.
Sure.
How do you reach people? How do you convince them you're stable enough and secure enough and are going to be sufficiently concerned about their welfare that they can give you their name and their address? But within a very short period of time and a lot of work, thousands of hours of work, calling, dialing, writing, footing the bill for the postage, we had an organization with over 200 members in Sacramento.
200 members.
And it must have been in the very beginning, there must have been some people that were very pro for it, and I said, I'm all over this. I want to join. I want to help out. Or was every single person a difficult challenge?
No, not everyone. We had a very small core group of us, probably less than 10, that did 90% of the work that was done. But it was a formative period for me. I learned an awful lot. I learned a lot about organizing. Mm-hmm. I learned that if you want to get people together, you have to touch them in lots of different ways. And you may be...
That's why you open a bathhouse.
you may be involved because you want the social opportunities. You want a chance to meet other men and have fun, or a place just to let your hair down and relax and not have to pretend to be somebody else. A few people I could use to try to educate about something. At that time in my life, one of my big pushes was venereal disease because it was really rampant in the gay community at that time, primarily.
Has it ever not been rampant? I mean,
well, much less of an emphasis, I think, at times.
Sure.
At that time, gonorrhea and syphilis were just common as could be, and chlamydia was also very common, and something called nonspecific urethritis, very common, NSU, important because the health authorities that would give us money to treat gonorrhea and syphilis would not give money to the local health departments to use to treat NSU because it was not classified as venereal disease. This classification game, if you can call it a this, you can get money and drugs to treat, get shots for it, but if it's called a this, you can't. I mean, it made no sense to me.
I think they still play those kinds of games even to this day.
With HIV and AIDS, yeah.
And, there was something else that's classified, because the human papillomavirus for the
HPV.
Genital warts is it's a venereal disease, and so that's why they're not giving it to young people, because it's that same kind of thing, because it's classified as a venereal disease prevention. So some things never change. But it was a lot of it was outreach and trying to get people cured from these diseases.
To try to educate people.
Right.
That my biggest thing is to make sure people understood how you catch these things, what it is, because the amount of ignorance was just stupendous. And as I got more involved with doctors to find out how dumb doctors were in terms of venereal disease, that had almost no training at all in terms of human sexuality, yet they were the very people that most people would think were the authority you go to if you have a, quote, sexual problem, need answers.
Now, Rick, you were making a living working as a lawyer at the time, defending a lot of people who were arrested for being gay, or?
No, at that time, I was, when David and I met, I had dropped out of school, out of college in Oklahoma, moved to California looking for David 11 months later.
You were looking for him?
Yeah, like, I knew there was a David, I didn't know what his name was, but I knew he had my name written on him, wherever he was, whatever he looked like, and I was really lucky.
How'd you meet him? And you didn't let go of him, huh?
11 months later, I found him.
How'd you meet him?
We were both interested in the same young man.
fighting over the hot stud.
No, he invited us to a party at his house and saw to it that we met, and it was love at first sight.
Or rivalry.
Really love. No rivalry at all. We both loved Randy in a different way. Randy was the name of the young man, interestingly enough.
Is he still around?
I don't know. Had no contact for many, many, many years.
So you guys fell in love, and you lived together for 35 years.
Right. But initially, because I was out of school, the decision was made that I should go back to school. And so I did night classes at first just to make sure that that would work. I really had the capabilities. I did. So I stopped working, went to school, graduated, got a degree with a major in Spanish, because Spanish is what I'd always loved. And so
qué bueno.
I went to Madrid and lived in Madrid for a year, perfecting the accent, came back. Taught Spanish for 2 years, but during that time I was becoming more and more politically active and more out as a gay man, and aware that as a school teacher, that was just a no-no. You couldn't be an out school teacher in 19, whatever that was, 66, 67.
Did you go to any gay bars in Madrid in the 1960s?
No, there were some bathhouses that I went to in Madrid, but I don't remember going in any gay bars. It wasn't necessary. Gay sexuality was so available in Madrid, and I went with the thought I'd have to be absolutely
closeted and
closeted with no sex for a year. Nothing could have been further from Madrid.
And you were like, that's party. And so why did you even come back to the United States? I mean, it's like
David was here.
Oh, because David.
Yeah.
And so David pulled you back to San Francisco.
Well, David and I.
So Sacramento,
Sacramento is where I met him, and we lived with his family for the first 6-7 years we were married, lived with his father and with his surviving sister. Mm-hmm. But then once I was teaching and realized that, one, I didn't have the kind of money to support the causes that I thought were worthwhile as a teacher, and I would never have them, and I'd always have the fear of being a teacher of being outed and losing a job, because at that time you could not be a teacher and be gay. So we decided that it would make more sense for me to go to law school. That was what I wanted to do. David was a lawyer. David's father was a lawyer. Two of David's brothers were lawyers, so in the family.
Raise your rates, so to speak.
And so I went to law school.
And your partner, David, could be out as a lawyer, too, because he was self-employed, wasn't he?
He was self-employed. Of course, he worked for his brother, and the family was a well-known family in Sacramento. His father was the law librarian at McGeorge Law School. So David wasn't public. I was the public one of us always. David was always with me, always supportive in every way of everything, and right there involved, and a very bright man on whose brains I relied to a large degree for big, important questions. It was always a family decision that we made.
So you were organizing these people in the late 60s in Sacramento and, you know, in California, and all of a sudden, Stonewall happens, 1969. And what was it like? I mean, to in New York City, all these like riots and cop cars being turned over, and you're in Sacramento, and what was going through your mind at that time?
Stonewall was a wonderful event, but our events were already happening here in San Francisco.
You were already having riots and turning cop cars upside down?
No, that didn't happen until Harvey was killed.
Okay,
and when the trial, when Dan Milks.
Where he was acquitted.
When the verdict came back in of acquittal, that's when that kind of rioting occurred here. But what was occurring before that, we had Glide Methodist Church, which is next door to the building we're in right now. And although I'm sure you know.
Oh, here? Right near the Hotel Mark
right
Twain?
Here, this building that we're in, the Mark Twain, under I think a different name at that time, was owned by Glide. Elizabeth Glide died way time in the Depression days, left a lot of money to the church, and part of it was left to set up a downtown church. And so here you have this huge church building, oftentimes at the most 10 to 15% filled on a Sunday, a goodly number of sailors usually, and a small congregation. A minister there named John Moore preached 3 sermons on homosexuality. I think that was in 65 or 66. Very significant event in San Francisco history, gay history.
Because of why?
Being in the center of the downtown where lots and lots of gay people live, I think John and the other ministers here were just aware of the needs of the gay community, the oppression that we suffered, the awful stuff from the police department, beatings, arrests, just the bad life that gay people had, and the church began to reach out to them.
The minister, John Moore, and his sermon was very affirming, and it was a departure from a lot of church, even the Methodist church at the time.
Right, there was. And GLIDE is just not the church with a minister. The GLIDE Foundation is the one that supports the church and makes the money by investment to keep the church going. Well, this church was changed from being a church with a very small congregation to being filled on those three Sundays. It was absolutely filled with everybody from suit-wearing gay types to leather types to you name it.
Drag queens?
Yep. Everybody.
Hippies and like the, even the coquettes and stuff like that?
The hippie came a little bit later.
Oh, not it wasn't there yet.
It was still beatnik, I think, then, right?
Yeah.
So it was people in black turtlenecks smoking like a joint outside and stuff.
Coming sometimes in. Inside.
Inside. Yeah. What a church.
What service. A very affirming church that must be. Yeah. But that's got to be one of the first churches in the country to ever do that.
Yes.
That's the first time I've ever.
So when you heard about this and the fact that this sort of like institution that for many years was sort of like oppressing gay people and their sexualities, all of a sudden this individual inside this institution speaks in for of your cause and your identity. How did that make you feel?
Elated, overjoyed, unbelieving, wanting to have a piece of it. We drove down from Sacramento to be here on those three Sundays, a very important event. About that same time, there was a meeting in the White Retreat in Mill Valley, and I'm trying to think what church that belongs to. I don't remember at the moment. A group of ministers from a number of liberal Protestant faiths and a group of gay people got together because up to that point, the church had been seen by so many gay people as the enemy or one of the enemies, almost as bad as the police. We were beat over the head with the church constantly as being sinners, mm-hmm. as defined in the church. So to have this concerted effort by religion to reach out to gay people, and out of that weekend retreat came the drive that produced the Council on Religion and the Homosexual. And that was really centered to a large degree here in GLIDE. Council on Religion and Homosexual, I was a member of with David for years and years and years. I was the president of for a period of time. There would be one to two meetings every year when you'd have a weekend set aside where you reached out to some profession to get people to come and learn about homosexuality. You'd have a large group of people, probably close to 200 to start in with, and you'd have major presentations made, then you'd break up into small groups of maybe 9 to 10 with a gay man and woman with this group of 9 to 10 people who were there, at least in the role of being straight. Most of them were straight, but some of them came out in the course of these weekends. A very affirming situation is if you've ever been in anything like that, you know just how emotional they get, how you watch people grow.
It's a type of retreat for these people.
Yes, so very much.
Get to learn and know about these gay people and accept them some more.
So you ran it. So you got involved in politics after that point, or
it all sort of was growing at the same time. An awareness that I had some public name in San Francisco because I represented a lot of gay people who had been busted. So my name was in the press, and I tended to fight cases. Up to that time,
how'd you fight those cases?
Well, first by convincing the clients that it was worth going to trial. Up to that time, so many clients would plead guilty. The DA, you have what's called registrable sex offenses in California,
sure.
And because the police department is the one who issues stamps, applications for licenses for just everything, the beauty shop attendants. You'd be amazed at how many people have to have these things. If you ever get convicted of a registrable sex offense, you couldn't get the license. So the police and the DA, by what they would permit you to plead guilty to, had an absolute door, a tremendous weapon to get you to plead guilty to a lesser offense so that you wouldn't have a registrable sex offense on your record, so you wouldn't have any trouble working. People would plead guilty in a second.
And so you said, let's fight this, let's stand up. And so what was like the legal construct that you would use to fight this? Would you say it's like being gay is okay, or was there prejudice or bias?
that it really was unconstitutional, that what we were being convicted under laws that were unconstitutional, the language were such was vague beyond belief. What does it mean to be this? What do these words really mean in reality? Well, they really mean whatever the cop wanted them to mean when he was arresting somebody.
And I was reading your bio, and it seems like you tied up a lot of the court's time and jury selection, too, because you had a whole list of questions. And it seemed like most people were like, this is really just kind of a dumb case. Can we just throw it out? Is that how most of those ended, that you couldn't even get through jury? Or did you actually go to trial for a lot of it?
Actually go to trial with a lot of them. But the opportunity, you're so right, the opportunity to use a courtroom as a way to educate a lot of people. A jury panel consisted of a lot of people sitting there waiting their time, bored to tears, whether they're going to get called or not. But they're sitting there listening while you're doing the voir dire. You're questioning and watching the other juror, the panel that's the prospective panel that's up there going to be in panel. You get to ask them their feelings about homosexuality, their feelings about the police officer. Would you believe this person just because he's a police officer more than you believe my client, who is at this in your eyes and under the system here, innocent until proven guilty. So in terms of what value you give to the words coming out of their mouths, why would you give more to this one than to that one? Are you gay?
Well, that's very clever, Rick.
And being here in San Francisco, too, you must have found a very sympathetic jury, I would imagine, because here, you know, everybody's got to know somebody that's gay, even back then.
You found very sympathetic juries and juries who felt it was such a waste of the taxpayers' money to be paying a police officer to be loitering around some restroom in the hopes they could catch somebody doing something.
So when did this change? When did that stop happening?
I would say this was in the 70s, the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s.
So even after Harvey Milk was elected as a city supervisor?
Yes.
And you've had people that are gay on the boards, there were still a lot of these laws around?
Yes.
Now, you ran against Harvey Milk.
Right.
Aren't you glad you didn't win?
I'm very glad I didn't win when I'm still alive, and I don't say that lightly or jestingly. Sure. But more importantly, I don't think I could have withstood the kind of public scrutiny that are given to public officials. I personally don't believe that if I elect you as my president, I own you 24 hours of the day. You still have a right to have your own private life. If you run my country well and do a good job, if I couldn't care less.
But aren't we curious, though? Don't we want to know everything about them?
Yeah, but do we have a right to? I don't think we do.
But we have a right to ask.
Well, you have a right to ask, perhaps, but do you really want the kind of...
I mean, don't you think it's a little titillating to see Barack Obama, shirtless walking through on a beach? You know?
Have you seen the photos?
Have you seen the photos of Barack Obama?
I haven't.
He has a surprisingly good body, you know?
He's been losing some weight.
He's in better shape than I am. It's like, you were saying before we started, you would have made a bad politician.
Well, just because I have a really hard time putting up with the, if you'll pardon the expression, two-facedness, because you're told by politicians whatever they think you want to hear today, and tomorrow they'll be telling somebody else whatever they think they want to hear. Now, not every politician falls into that, but an awful lot of them do.
Are you saying that the nature of American politics is deceitful?
Yes, and that people know when they're candidates, and unless you're elected, you have no power. So the first thing is, how do I get elected? And once
you get elected, it's every man for himself? Or?
You have more power than you had before. But then, look at Bill Clinton's case. I mean, you find out right away that when you don't control the House and the Senate, no matter what you want to do, you have severe limitations on your power. You just can't do. People get elected and make all kinds of promises. And whether they're made deceitfully because they don't know any better, I'm not sure, but once they get in power, they find out they really don't have the power to do what they've led people to believe they were going to do.
What was that race like against Harvey Milk? Was it just you against him, or was it a bunch of people running for this? I'm not sure how elections go here in San Francisco for something like that.
There were a number of people. I'm trying to think of the name of the other man who came in second, and I can't escape it at the moment. But
so it wasn't the election.
Was this person gay as well?
No.
Okay.
No.
So it wasn't like the election against Gray Davis or the recall where you had all these Gary Coleman and sort of a very
eclectic crowd
all fighting for the same political space.
So there was three of you running against us.
Three significant candidates. There were other candidates, but three that were at the top.
And so you didn't win.
Terrence Hallinan was the name of the other.
So you didn't win, and then sort of Harvey Milk Because a lot of listeners may not be the movie hasn't come out yet, and they may not read the Wikipedia entry. But why was Harvey Milk so charismatic or such a loved political leader?
Was he loved?
Yes, I think so. Right, he was able to generate a certain kind of respect and response. Harvey was a street person, or able to put on that
toughness,
outer face. Uh-huh. And that he was behind and for the street people. We have a major element in our political life here in San Francisco today on our Board of Supervisors that still follows from that, representing issues that most of the people in San Francisco would probably not be in favor.
Which is?
The whole issue, the housing issues, is a big one.
For like the homeless and
the homeless is an ideal one to put in. The pigeons. I mean, everybody realizes who owns any property in San Francisco that pigeons are not an asset, and yet you have a significant amount enough to make a group who are able to make enough noise to keep the city from really undertaking any action to remove pigeons from the city. I mean, it's a prime example. How can you have a thing which is so negative in so many ways and yet is able to get enough votes and support behind it that nothing can be done about it?
So the city doesn't, like, exterminate or make any attempts to reduce or control the pigeon population?
No.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, there's a pigeon net right outside of our window. We're trying to figure out, why is this net here? It was like, so people don't throw garbage into the well. But then we're like, oh, it's got to be for pigeons.
Yeah, it's exactly what it's for.
So, I mean, in a sense, and this is a kind of a controversial thing. Are you comparing homeless people to, like, are they like pests in a sense or like pigeons or?
Well, certainly their behavior can be pest-like. I have zero sympathy for the person who uses the street for a toilet. Because other people have to walk along that street. And we're one of the prime tourist locations in the world. And we have a city, at least when I came here, was a beautiful city. It's still a beautiful city. But it's very tawdry, tattered around the edges from the pigeon stuff, from the people, the stuff from the people who live in the streets who wouldn't accept housing when you offer them housing. They don't want to live off the streets. They don't want the restrictions. They're not able, either because of their own mental problems or their drug problems, to live in that sort of a structured society. They don't want that at all.
And so when Harvey Milk was assassinated, what was sort of the reaction in the community?
Well, outrage, first of all. Anger. What are we going to do? And there was a lot of faith that the court system would take care of it, that White would actually wind up serving, going to jail for Harvey's assassination. And of course, when the verdicts came back, as they did, people couldn't take that. So this was when the real San Francisco riots occurred. The doors of City Hall were broken in. Squad cars were set on fire and turned upside down. It was a really bad scene. It was a total anarchy, chaos. And yet, maybe it was needed. Maybe it was the only way to drive home the point to the city that this is just not acceptable.
We're not going to put up. Do you see something like that ever happening again today?
I hope not. Because although it did produce good results, a lot of people got hurt. I like to think there are better, more constructive ways of reaching those results without having to go through that kind of activity. But I'm aware sometimes not. Sometimes you can't get anybody to pay any attention until you drive home the point. You find some way of reaching that individual. And here in San Francisco, the street riots, the riots on the night of the Harvey Milk verdict coming back on Dan White was what that force was. You could try to compare with Stonewall. Mm-hmm. What was it in Stonewall? What ignited that group of people in that bar? I mean, it's like you finally reach a point and people say, no more. I'm not going to tolerate this crap anymore.
Now, as a lawyer, did you follow the trial?
I'm sure I did.
Don't remember.
The defense that he ate junk food and it made him crazy, he ate Twinkies and stuff like that, just seems so outrageous in this day and age. But did it make any kind of sense back then?
No, it was laughable.
It was laughable then.
But it was effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that it cost the judge or the trial lawyers or the defense attorneys any political currency to make such an outrageous defense and actually be successful with it?
No, I don't think it costs the defense lawyers anything. People like that usually are judged on their effectiveness, and if they get somebody off, that's judged as being a good, effective lawyer.
But the judge certainly,
Or the jury.
Feather. You know, it's like that's such a ridiculous thing to this day and age, and probably like that's, you know, their legacy. I don't even know the name of the judge that presided over that trial, but I'm sure that they're, you know, hiding in shame to this day about it.
Well, judges aren't ones that hide in shame very well or for very long, if at all. But think about the gay defense.
Sure.
The first time that was brought forth, and then, I mean, how utterly ridiculous that you could be so upset and offended, and you're a straight man, mm-hmm. and I've sort of put my hand on your leg and making overtures towards you, that you could be so pushed out that you could use your upsetness as a defense for why you then beat me to death. I mean, how preposterous is that? And yet it was used for years here. I don't think it's accepted very much at all now as a defense. It's not effective.
Well, I think it's still being used. I mean, there was we've reported several times that, you know, some gay bashings where the not the victim, but the attacker used that defense, you know, that their masculinity is being threatened, and therefore the irrational nature of the violence was justified in some sense.
But most recently came out here in California, in a little town nearby, there was a young woman who was a male living as a female who had had sex with these four men, and they beat her to death. And two of them were alleging they didn't know that she was a man until that night. They'd ripped her clothes off and felt the genitals to find out that it was a man. But it didn't buy, I mean, the jury didn't buy that in that case.
Mm-hmm. So you started, you and some group of investors started a gay men's bathhouse.
A group of us all like to go to bathhouses, but the bathhouse.
Who doesn't?
Bathhouses.
I'll see you, Lane, pointing to your hot Russian assistant sitting behind you.
The bathhouses were pretty seedy at that time, the kind of places you climb up on the bed and wipe your feet off because you want to track the dirt off the floor and the sheet. And we thought, if there must be other people just like us who would come to a nice bathhouse if it were built. And I got there were 17 or 18 of us to begin with.
You wanted to be the champagne of bathhouses, like sort of like Budweiser.
Mm-hmm. We had no idea we would have the kind of fantastic success that we had when we started.
Were you worried? I mean, you were investing so much of your money and resources to start. What was the name of the first? It wasn't Steamworks, was
no,
it?
No, Rich Street Bathhouse.
Rich Street Bathhouse.
Rich Street Health Club.
Health Club.
Call them health clubs.
Because there were very healthy appetites right, there.
Right. And was there a big bathhouse scene in San Francisco? Because I know it's like bathhouses used to be, especially like turn of the century, because a lot of people didn't necessarily have a bath in their house, so they would go to bathhouses and get cleaned up.
Or have a hot stud to have sex with in their house, either.
But then I think later, as people got more indoor plumbing and stuff like that, what was I going to say? Was it a big bathhouse culture in this town?
It was, but it wasn't a bathhouse culture for the reason that you're talking about. Okay. It was primarily the bathhouse culture I'm familiar with, uh-huh. were men going to bathhouses looking to meet other men. Okay. That was what it was for. You did have a historical huge bathhouse here built out on the ocean that was where people would go and swim, mm-hmm. huge indoor swimming pool, all glassed in.
How beautiful does that sound? I mean, so you had this very successful gay men's bathhouse, health club. And when did that go from transitioning into what we know as the Steamworks chain today? You guys bought a place in Berkeley.
We did. However, we had sold out. David and I were two of the three people who ran the Ridge Street Health Club. So, and in about 1976, 77, because the gay scene in San Francisco had changed so much, when we built Rich Street, we opened it in, as I recall, it was 65, 66, gay men still wanted to slip away down a dark alley, a place where no one they knew or worked with was going to see them, and Rich Street fit that perfectly. It was an industrial area where after 4:30, 5 o'clock, no one on the streets
dead.
At all.
Dead.
But in the ensuing years, increasingly, the gay community was coming out. Gay bars and bathhouses were being built in places to where, you might see the guy who you work for going, and that wasn't the reason to go and run. So Rich Street was losing some of its popularity, had lost some of its popularity. The 8th and Howard bathhouse had been built, was very popular here. There were a number of bathhouses in the city, some of which predated us, and it had to clean up their act to compete with us.
So it was vital to have the establishment located in a place that was sort of out of the way. And as the city changed, Rich Street became less desirable to go to, and that's why you guys moved to Berkeley.
Well, we sold that, and then we were offered the opportunity, I guess at the same time or just before we sold it, David and I were offered an opportunity to invest with another small group of guys and buy the Berkeley Bass. It was the first bass that we bought.
And you, did you call it Steamworks then?
No, it was called the Mayan Health Club, as I recall.
Feel the thunder of the snake serpent. Snake
Quetzalcoatl
god.
Coming for you.
Quetzalcoatl,
yes.
And all his feathers. And so when did because Steamworks is such a clever but unique, and it seems like such a modern sounding name, but when was it actually coined?
Well, soon after we bought it, when it was operated as the Mayan, when we bought it, we began looking for the name we were going to market our chain under. This was the first of what was going to be the chain. And interestingly, the bathhouse that was our ideal that we were going to be building on them was a small bathhouse that could be run with one employee on slow times.
A one-employee bathhouse.
Could. Ideally located in a college town, a town of at least 100,000 people, and a town at least 100 miles away from a large area like San Francisco or Sacramento or Los Angeles, so that people, too far for people to drive to where they'd want to go somewhere locally. We never built a single one of those. We bought other bathhouses around the United States and out of the United States.
What year was that? Like, was the Steamworks name coined in the late 70s, early?
That would have been 67 or 68, the very beginning.
1968, the word Steamworks.
Yeah.
Was associated with this business. Isn't that amazing?
We just love the word Steamworks.
I mean, really. So what made you go, it's like, this would be a good name for a gay men's bathhouse, you know?
Well, there were maybe seven or eight of us at that time looking, trying to figure out what would be a good name that would sort of identify with a Steamworks, a steam establishment.
Sure.
And yet produces with a logo that was an interesting theme, the idea of a big steam valve. Had a certain masculinity
releasing
to
the
it.
Pressure. Yeah. and so were there other names that you guys considered, like, you know, steam engine or waterworks or?
I'm sure there were many of them. I couldn't tell you what any of them.
Because somebody
are
probably
now.
Fought for somebody for another name. Because I know how it is with groups of people. You know, like Feast of Fools wasn't an easy battle to fight for me early on. Believe me, I was like going. I fought for that name, and it's like they wanted to call it Feast Cabaret and all sorts of ridiculous names.
Buffet of dunces.
The buffet of buffoons.
I'm sure part of your thought pattern was looking for something that lent itself to good advertising.
And cleverness.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was what the Steamworks thing, there were lots of things that we could do with that.
And then you opened up a chain in Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh.
What year was that opened? God. I did the research, but it was 1977? Is that right?
That sounds about right. It might have been a little before that we bought the business first down there and weren't able to buy the building.
So you were telling me there was a gay men's bathhouse in Puerto Rico all throughout my entire life and I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
I feel cheated almost, Rick.
The Lions Club at that time when we bought it.
It's amazing. And it was the middle of old San Juan. Mm-hmm. And then you lived in Puerto Rico for many years.
Well, more accurately, anywhere we open a business, I own a home. I buy a home because we're going to be there. And rather than paying hotel bills, it makes more sense to own the house. And
what was it like for you living in Puerto Rico, though? It's kind of hard for me to imagine. Well, you're bilingual, so
right.
We could do this interview in Espanol.
Oh, sí.
But again, living is where I never, quote, lived there. I went to Puerto Rico whenever I'm working on the business. I need to be there for sometimes extended periods, but usually it's more like a month or less that I'd be there. So live in that sense, getting very much involved in the community, having lots of friends there. In that sense, I very much lived there, but it was never a place that I voted from, for example.
How did you like the gay life in Puerto Rico?
Very exciting. I love Latin men.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
and most interesting, the Puerto Rican man, even though he may not be gay, he's very acutely aware of the fact that he's being cruised by you and will look at you and grin at a time. But it's confusing because you don't know what that grin means.
It's a different kind of aesthetic because I think as Americans, they don't realize just how overly, I think, masculine and homophobic we can be as Americans, whereas a lot of people from other cultures, you know, they can be a little more feminine or what we would perceive as feminine, but they're just very comfortable with who they are and they're just more of kind of like, you know, they're who they are and they're not worried about being like like some kind of John Wayne.
Well, that's why I like Eastern Europeans, you know, especially walking around here in San Francisco. It's like a lot of these European guys, they're very attractive. Mm-hmm. And you smile at them and go, I'm in room 910 at the Hotel Mark Twain.
And they're all like, why would I need that?
Why would I need to know that? I don't understand.
Well, and the Puerto Rican man, mm-hmm. masculine and sexy as he is, may be married, have a wife and kids, but still finds time to sample the other wares.
I'm always surprised how they pluck their eyebrows down there. I'm just like,
well, that's a new thing.
Is that a new thing?
And I have to say, you know, growing up in Puerto Rico, and it really is a modernization, the whole sort of like defense. You know, this is the problem with progress, is that more and more people become aware that gays exist and that they have gay feelings inside themselves too. There also becomes this sort of counter reaction where they get sort of like scared and macho and intimidated. But like if you travel to certain parts of Puerto Rico, like the southwest side of the island, you can flirt with anybody and they're just delighted with that. Whereas in the city, like in San Juan, they're a little bit more defensive. Do you share that experience that I have? That observation?
Yeah, as you get away from cities, I think anywhere, you're more likely to find, at the same time, people who are very open and willing and receptive to you, but they much more fit into their behavior needs to fit into the societal norm that they're used to. It doesn't mean they won't play in a second if given an opportunity. But it may need to be more hidden in some of those contexts.
You have to separate them from the herd is what you have to do.
But just so much of the stuff we're talking about, the 60s was such a time of foment. Uh-huh. The 54 Civil Rights Act, gays were watching blacks beginning to organize mm-hmm. and acquire rights. And I'm sure many of us, me especially, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to use the very same techniques that these people that are brothers and sisters are using and successfully. We can do that too. And we should be, and we were, working. I look back at my life and all of the things that I was involved in, and sometimes I wonder how I ever managed to live, because there were just too many things going on. But there was a time, for me at least, when there weren't that many of us, and the feeling that whenever you have a position of security like I had, particularly when I'm practicing law, I don't have to worry about somebody firing me or somebody, you know, being able to hurt me in some way, where I had so many gay brothers and sisters who would have loved to have been doing what I could do, mm-hmm. but couldn't. Couldn't because, I mean, they'd lose a job or lose their kids. If it's a woman, at that time, usually it was gay women who mm-hmm. had kids.
Well, that's why sort of gay rights is very tied to being, like, financially or economically secure.
Yes.
And sometimes people might misunderstand that being superficial, being money-obsessed, but what it really means is about having an independence and an ability to fight for your own voice.
Security.
For
that's exactly
security.
What it means. Yeah. I mean, no matter how much you believe in something, unless you're crazy, you have to realize, where am I going to eat tonight and where am I going to sleep? Those things come first. Once you've gotten that behind you, know you're secure, then you can go out and take the liberty to start fighting for these issues that you think are important.
So now Steamworks is the largest gay men's bathhouse in the chain of gay men's bathhouses in the world. It's 2008. What is the most important issue we face as gay people today? And from, you know, because you've been there, you've seen so much. Are we missing the mark?
No, I think we still have the same issues. The thing that's really different for us is we have a so far incurable sexually transmitted disease, which is always the specter that's there in everything that we do.
But do you think that we're overreacting to HIV and AIDS a little bit?
No way.
No way. Why is it so such an important thing still to this day, even though, we've made progress in treating and preventing this disease?
But we lost, I don't know what the numbers are now, but probably 55,000 people here in San Francisco of our most promising people, the leaders in so many things. I mean, others that weren't leaders, but many of them were the cream of the crop that we lost. We have young people coming along who've not lived through seeing all of the people that are sick, that are hobbling down the street on a cane, having to go to the hospital every other day to see some friend and hold their hand. We as an older, and here I'm talking about myself more than you, you're much younger than I, we have a duty to see to it that younger people aren't permitted to forget that this thing is constantly out there. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, it's the hidden threat.
The problem, too, is that a lot of people, we don't really realize what we're missing, because those people aren't there. And so all of the art, all the fantastic things that they've done, the supporting the community and stuff like, it's not there because they're not there. And it's hard to put a value, I guess, on what's missing.
Well, it's also the money, you know? Too, because it's like a lot of these sort of like gay community leaders and figureheads, they died, and a lot of their finances, I mean, one great example is the Rumba restaurant they used to perform at. Mm-hmm.
And Vortex in
Chicago. The owner died, and then the heterosexual family members took over and sold it and turned it into condos.
Well, in Puerto Rico, as you're referring, Los Arcos was the most prominent of the gay guest houses. The whole Condado Beach area, that was a mile mm-hmm. and a half, 2 miles of gay guest house after mm-hmm. gay guest house. Los Arcos was the number one. Peter, who was the owner, was from New York. Peter died of AIDS. A few years later, it's been sold, it's been torn down, it's been redeveloped with condos on it. I think there are two or three functioning gay guest houses in the condado, and there were like 25 whenever we started business down there. Mm-hmm.
And that's as a direct of AIDS.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. So, at the same time, you don't want to unduly frighten people, mm-hmm. but you do want to make sure people are aware.
The mm-hmm. impact is huge.
Is that why Steamworks mm-hmm. is like so involved? And I mean, you guys give back so much of your income and your money. I mean, you could be buying, you know, mansions and filling them with, you know, male hustlers from the Ukraine. Instead, you guys like donate to so many different kinds of or political organizations and cultural organizations. And you're one of the major sponsors of this program yourself. Is that really like a really critical aspect of Steamworks's existence?
It is, and it's part of it predates AIDS. Growing up, growing up gay in Sacramento in those early years with David, I saw it firsthand how few of the gay businesses gave back anything to the community, anything. And yet there are places making money hand over fist off of us, our community, going to bars, and yet the bars, you know, would just weren't there to be supportive of gay issues. And David and I, from the beginning, you know, it's our money. It's coming from our community. It goes back to our community. That's
well, we want to thank you so much. I mean, you know, you guys have a profound impact. Not just I think it's just not the money, but just the fact that you guys are sort of fighting to keep these bathhouses open. Because in San Francisco, in its reaction to HIV and AIDS, there was this sort of like community panic to shut down gay bathhouses because they saw them as the place where gay sex was happening. And therefore, they equated gay sex with death. And so if we shut down these gay bathhouses, we stop this disease, which was a mistake.
I mean, it was hard to teach people. It's what you do, not sure. where you do it.
Well, and certainly, you know, I think that, is there any possibility of Steamworks ever moving to the city of San Francisco or its roots?
If there were an end to AIDS, yes, there would be a real possibility of that. But the reality is the business community in San Francisco has lots of trouble dealing with the city government. I mean, and this is any business. Mm-hmm. It's a very unbusiness-friendly government in lots and lots of ways. And you can go to communities around the United States and probably around the world and find governments that see their job as a way of helping businesses get started and do whatever it is that they want to do, rather than how do we stop them. And a lot of times you get the distinct impression in San Francisco it's more the latter. How do you stop businesses? How do you raise barriers to people doing the things that they want to do, the legal things?
Mm. Mm. Well, Rick, we want to thank you so much for talking to us today and for sharing your story. Are you flattered? I mean, are you excited about Milk, the movie coming out, and Steven Spinella portraying you in this movie, actor?
Well, I am, but the flattery and the excitement is probably somewhat tempered. We haven't mentioned there wasn't any reason to the earlier movie, The Word Is Out, that David and I were both in, that came out in 77, 78. And there's a new release, there's a new videotape been done of those of us who are survivors out of that, I think it was 28 people that originally were in The Word Is Out.
What's The Word Is Out? I'm not familiar with it. I'm sorry. I didn't see it in the material.
Peter Adair was a filmmaker and a gay man, and Peter and a group called the Mariposa Film Group.
The Butterfly Film Group.
made this movie, and Peter wanted to be able to show what gay people were like, because we were so unknown mm-hmm. in the general community. And he came, approached eight of us and asked us if we'd be willing to be in the film. And I was one of those original eight
people. So you played yourself in this movie?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, but was it more of a documentary, or was it like a dramatization?
A documentary, but it was really showing our lives. at a time when most Americans had no idea who we are, where we are, what we're like, from Whitey, the white-haired woman in Marin, to the young woman in this, in Virginia, who was, I think, a veterinarian, to David and I, who were two lawyers, George Mendenhall, who was here from San Francisco.
And this has been re-released, did you say?
This is 30th anniversary, and so they've just done a restored version of it. It was shown in the film festival this last year, and part of the people who have the Mariposa group came around and interviewed those of us still alive who are willing to participate, have a new videotape, which is a DVD that's going to be released along with the restored version of Word Is Out this fall, about the same time as the Milk film. So all of this will be coming at one time.
Well, we'll definitely keep a lookout for that, for sure.
Yeah.
But you were not involved in Milk at all. So your character, who's being played by, what is it, Steven Spinelli?
Steven Spinella.
Spinella. He didn't call you and say, like, you know, how do you talk?
Like?
What do you like? Or anything like that.
So no. It could be completely, I mean, it's kind of shocking to see somebody portraying you in a movie and then there doesn't sound like it. He'd be like, hey, how are you doing? You know, I'm Rick Stokes.
I was disappointed that it wasn't a little more effort made, you know, to have some contact with me, but there wasn't, and I didn't make the movie. So.
It's not like you're invisible or hard to find. You know, just go to any Steamworks.
Are you going
to
see it at opening night?
We probably will.
Will
yeah.
You?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's going to be incredibly satisfying in a sense, you know. And you're like, I lived.
Well, and
that's, oh, so
that's just kidding.
And the milk story is a very important part of our lives. A
yeah,
very
it is.
Important.
Yeah, and it's huge. A lesson that we've learned, you know, and hopefully that we don't repeat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you feel like? What do you want to leave our listeners with? What kind of words of inspiration or motivation for them?
That there is absolutely nothing we can't do. Nothing. In Sacramento, I put on while I was in law school, in my second year of law school, decided it was time to educate Sacramentans and put on a program at the United Methodist Church, a huge downtown Methodist church. Personally went to every elected official in Sacramento, went to the ministers of all the churches, went to all of the news media. We had a filled church with probably 50 people outside trying to hear because of what was going on. When we had a psychiatrist, a minister, a lawyer, a different representatives talking about homosexuality. And I just thought, anybody would have laughed at me 6 months ago when this idea had come up to me that I could do, that you could do it. But I found out there is nothing, and I really mean that, nothing we can't do. All you got to do is want to do it badly enough. If you're lucky, you'll find another person to go along with you and do it with you. But don't count on it. It may be just you.
Or just like nag them to death until they do it. We want to remind our listeners, we want to thank you so much, Rick,
thank
for coming
you,
on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
We want to remind our listeners that you can comment and share your thoughts and ideas on the interview with Rick Stokes on today's show through our website, feastoffools.net. And remember that today's show was brought to you in part by Steamworks, Gym, Sauna, and Bath.
Release the pressure.
Saca la presión, Steamworks. Steamworks is a comfortable and stylish place to meet other men, relax, work out, and play. Open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to men 18 and over in Berkeley, Chicago, Toronto, and now Seattle, Washington. When you're ready to play,
Steamworks is there for you.
Visit steamworksonline.com and register to get a discount on your next visit. Enter Feast of Fools on the promo code field to get that very special discount. Remember, folks,
play hard, play smart.
That means use a condom.
Right.
You're going to use a condom, right, Rick?
There's lots of
right.
ways to play smart.
There's not always a good time to go to Steamworks.
That's right.
Anytime. And that's actually what we're going to go be doing right now. So you can listen tomorrow. We're going to be doing a audio sound scene tour of Steamworks in Berkeley. So we want to thank you again, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
Have fun tomorrow.
Yes. Well, tomorrow's now, but, you know, for the listeners, they're going to have to wait.
It's time shifted.
The music featured on today's show is the music by Rachel Sage. You can support independent musicians and buy her music on our website, feastoffools.net, home of fabulousness. Remember, Rick Stokes does not have a Wikipedia entry, people. One of you guys knows how to do it. Get this man a Wikipedia entry. He is a living legacy to gay and lesbian queer people everywhere. We want to salute you, Rick, and thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Friend, would you treat me so unkindly? If I wasn't she who would, then would you climb this tree so blindly? Recognition, gonna be so sweet. Gonna give me power. Gonna become just.
come in just like a wild flower. Are you gonna lie to me? Are you gonna keep talking? Are you gonna cry for me? Are you gonna just keep talking?